Thank you. Good morning. The title of my talk today is Herpes Zoster Vaccine Implementation Issues. So in a way of outline, I'm going to start with some background on clinical manifestations of herpes zoster, which I abbreviate HZ, epidemiology of zoster, the pivotal zoster vaccine study, which I abbreviate HZV, and then I'll finish up talking about recommendations and implementation issues relating to zoster and zoster vaccine. So first, some clinical manifestations of zoster. So zoster, which is also called shingles, is a reactivation of the varicella zoster virus, or VZV, which leads to a crop of blisters, shown in the lower left over there, supplied by sensory nerves from one nerve root in a dermatomal pattern. And this on the lower right is a dermatome map, which shows the different dermatomes. After initial infection causing chickenpox, VZV establishes a latent infection in nerve cell bodies along the central nervous system. Years or decades later, the VZV reactivates, and the VZV virions reappear and spread to the skin via peripheral nerves. So what are the main manifestations of zoster? Well, the first one is rash. It's unilateral, 1 to 3 adjacent dermatomes, typically resolves over 5 to 25 days. Some of the complications can be bacterial infections or permanent scarring. VZV from rash can spread to susceptible persons and cause varicella, but zoster is much less contagious than varicella. So these are some photographs, the first being a thoracic distribution, T1, T2, second also is thoracic, T7, T8, the last one is lumbar, L3, L4. Here's some cranial nerve involvement. This is a mandibular division of the trigeminal nerve, the ophthalmic division of the trigeminal nerve. The other main manifestation of zoster is pain, which often precedes the rash by days or weeks. It can be excruciating. It's been described as aching, burning, stabbing, or shock-like. It could be continuous or paroxysmal. And it's often associated with altered or painful sensitivity to touch, provoked by trivial stimuli, like bed sheets, and can cause unbearable itching as well. The complications of zoster, the primary one is postherpetic neuralgia, PHN, which is the prolonged, often severe pain after the resolution of the rash. And there are variable definitions of prolonged used by clinicians and by researchers. But regardless, the pain can persist for months or even years, and some persons experience recurrence as well. There's no consistently effective way to prevent or to treat PHN. So what are the impacts of PHN on the quality of life? Well, these have been evaluated in formal studies and found to be comparable to the impacts from congestive heart failure, diabetes, and depression. And the impacts come through a number of different domains: physical domain, psychological domain, social domain, functional domain. There are a number of anecdotes that we hear about of people committing suicide because of severe postherpetic neuralgia. Another more common complication of herpes zoster is herpes zoster ophthalmicus, which is involvement of the ophthalmic division of the trigeminal nerve. It occurs maybe 15% at a time, and it can lead to chronic complications and even to blindness. There are a whole variety of less common complications from zoster, and I'm not going to spend time on those, except to say that they are much more common in immunocompromised individuals. And in addition to that, they could be much more severe. So they can lead, for instance, the most important one being dissemination with a generalized rash with or without visceral involvement, i.e. pneumonia, encephalitis, and hepatitis. Mortality is quite rare in immunocompetent people. Most of the mortality occurs in the immunocompromised persons. Now we'll shift to the epidemiology of zoster. There are about 3 to 4 cases per 1,000 population per year, which translates to about 1 million cases in the US annually. The age-adjusted rates appear to be increasing, as Aisha just mentioned in her presentation. And the lifetime risk of developing zoster is about 30%, 1 out of 3 people almost. What are the risk factors for zoster? Well, the key one is age. This is the dominant factor that influences the incidence in the population. But in addition to that, there's immunosuppression, which is less common, but it's influential due to the magnitude of the risk. So following bone marrow transplant, patients with hematologic malignancies, persons with HIV, the risk is increased many, many fold compared to age-matched persons. So let's look at that in the next slide. This is a famous study by Dr. Edgar Hope Simpson done in the UK, and the y-axis shows the incidence of zoster per 1,000 per year. The x-axis shows age, and it's showing you the impact of age on incidence, and you'll see how it really takes off after the age of 50. In fact, in persons over 80, the risk of zoster, the annual risk of zoster is about 6 times that of younger adults. There are other lower magnitude and unconfirmed risk factors for zoster. They include gender. Most studies show an increase in women. Race, it appears to be more common in whites than in blacks. Local trauma, the risk following trauma to a particular limb is increased compared to control limbs, maybe 12-fold. Stress has been is a risk factor, and that's the most common anecdote people report in association with stress, although in truth there's only been one study that suggested an association with stress, so that needs to be validated. Certain illnesses are also associated, Crohn's disease, diabetes, rheumatoid arthritis, and that's even taking out the effect of immunosuppressive drugs that they might be on. Varicella exposure, and Aisha touched on that also, there's a theory, and it's based on some empiric evidence, that exposure to varicella boosts your immunity and thereby reduces the risk of shingles, but that needs to be verified. But the important thing is that we don't really know why 30% of people get shingles during the course of a life, whereas the other 70% do not. Let's talk about the epidemiology of PHN. The proportion of zoster patients that go on to develop PHN, as I mentioned, there are different definitions for PHN. So if you define it as 90 days of pain, it's about 10% of people. If you define it as 30 days of pain, it's about 18% of the people. In either event, that translates to 1 to 200,000 new PHN cases per year. What are the risk factors for PHN? Of those with zoster, age is the key risk factor for developing PHN. The risk of progressing to PHN in zoster patients for a young adult, 22 to 49, is about 6%, but for a person 80 and over, it's 20%. So when you combine the fact that the elderly are at greater risk of zoster and those that develop zoster are at greater risk if they're older, then the risk of somebody over 80 compared to somebody under 40 of developing PHN is maybe 20-fold. Let's move and talk now about the shingles prevention study. This was a double-blind, placebo-controlled, multi-center trial. They enrolled almost 40,000 persons over 60 and over, randomized to receive either the zoster vaccine or the placebo. And the zoster vaccine is comprised of an attenuated form of the VZV, which is identical to that in Varivax and ProQuad, but it's at a 14 higher titer than Varivax. The follow-up was about, the median was about 3.1 years of follow-up. This was published in the New England Journal in June 2005. Here are the results. In the first frame, the white bar shows efficacy, the y-axis shows vaccine efficacy, and the left frame shows efficacy in the white bar against zoster in all comers. It was about 51% effective. It was more effective against against PHN, 67%. Now the right frame shows this broken down by age strata, going from 60 to 64 on the left all the way out to over 79 and over 79 on the right. And you'll see that for zoster, the white bar is it goes down to from starting from about 70% down to below 20%. But the efficacy against PHN is better retained, and even in the elderly, it's about 40%. In persons over 80. Looking at the results a different way, looking at the efficacy against different outcomes of PHN, going from 30 on the left side, from 30 down to 180 days of PHN. And on the right side, it shows vaccine efficacy. And you see that the efficacy is increasingly better the more severe the outcome you're trying to prevent. So it's 73% effective at preventing PHN lasting 6 months. What about adverse events? Well, it appears to be pretty safe. There was no pattern suggesting any causal link to serious adverse events. Vaccine rashes did not occur in the trial. There were an excess of local injection site reactions, about 48% in the vaccinees compared to 17 in the placebo recipients. What about durability of protection? Well, the efficacy against zoster and PHN declined during the first year after the vaccination. The first year of observation, but it remained stable just over 50% for the remaining 3 years of observation. So now we're going to move to the crux of the talk about recommendations and implementations of zoster vaccine. So the FDA licensed the zoster vaccine in May 2006, and a number of months later, in October 2006, ACIP considered the vaccine, and they recommended provisionally a dose of the zoster vaccine for all adults 60 years and older, unless they have contraindications. So let's take that into some of its key elements. Zoster vaccine should be offered at the patient's first available clinical encounter. And the rationale for that is that the average adult over 60 has 5 to 8 clinical encounters a year. So zoster can be given at the first available opportunity. It can, of course, be given along with influenza vaccine, and we'll talk about that in the next slide as well. Another point is that residents of chronic care facilities should be included in vaccination activities if no contraindications exist. They shouldn't fall through the cracks. So, as I mentioned in the last slide, zoster vaccine can be administered with other vaccines. Simultaneous administration with live or inactivated vaccines is acceptable, as is non-simultaneous administration with inactivated vaccines. The only issue arises is when you're giving two live vaccines. They should be given simultaneously. If they're not, they should be separated by at least 28 days. Now, this is not really an issue, very common issue with zoster vaccine. The only live vaccine you would typically give somebody 60 and older might be maybe yellow fever and a traveler. There aren't really any others that are typically given, but it could be a problem if somebody inadvertently gave the varicella vaccine instead of shingles vaccine, in which case they would need to that would not be considered acceptable vaccination against shingles vaccine, and if you weren't able to correct the error that same day, you'd have to wait 28 days in order to give the zoster vaccine. Zoster vaccine is recommended whether or not the patient reports a prior episode of zoster. And this is a little bit different than the package insert for Zostavax. The rationale for that is that patients, and less commonly doctors, misdiagnose zoster, and there are no good tools to confirm or rule out a history of prior zoster. So therefore, validating a zoster history can be a real challenge for providers and introduce a major barrier to vaccination. Also, having more than one episode of zoster is not as uncommon as once thought. The rate of zoster after a prior episode may actually be similar to the rate of a first episode. Of note, following an episode of zoster, there's no specific minimal time interval before one can receive the zoster vaccine. It's not necessary to check varicella history or titers before administering zoster vaccine. And the reason for that is that virtually all persons 16 and over have serologic evidence of prior varicella, even if they don't recall having the disease. There is no evidence that zoster vaccine inadvertently given to persons without prior varicella raises safety concerns, although that has not been formally studied in more than a handful of people. Nonetheless, determining a varicella history would introduce a major and unnecessary barrier to vaccination. Zoster vaccine should be offered to eligible persons, including those over 80 years of age, frail, or with chronic illnesses. I've heard physicians and others saying that, well, we shouldn't really give the vaccine to persons over 80, but I would disagree with that. While zoster vaccine is less effective at preventing zoster in persons over 80 years of age, its effectiveness at preventing PHN is better, as I mentioned in the earlier slide. In addition to that, and more important, the oldest and the frailest population are the ones that experience the largest burden of zoster and PHN, as I mentioned earlier, and so even less effectiveness translates to more prevention in the population. In addition to that, the oldest old are the least able to seek medical attention and to access care. They're the least able to tolerate the powerful medications, the tricyclic antidepressants and the opiates and all these medications that are used to control pain. Finally, they have the least physical, social, psychological reserve to handle zoster and PHN. And zoster and PHN can often cause people to tip into this spiral where they end up needing more institutional care. Zoster vaccine must be kept at below 5 degrees Fahrenheit until reconstitution. Any freezer with a separate sealed freezer door that can reliably maintain an average temperature under 5 degrees Fahrenheit is acceptable. Dorm-style units are not. Caution, for some combined refrigerator-freezer models, setting the freezer to low temperatures for the zoster vaccine can reduce the refrigerator temperatures to below 32 degrees Fahrenheit, and that could ruin refrigerator-stable vaccines like pertussis vaccine and everything, so you need to be aware of that. Unused zoster vaccine must be discarded within 30 minutes after reconstitution. Immunosuppression, that is persons on high-dose steroids, biological response modifiers, chemotherapy, and AIDS, is a contraindication for zoster vaccine, but there is neither a contraindication nor recommendation to offer zoster vaccine to HIV-infected persons without AIDS. However, expert opinion is that zoster vaccine is likely to be safe for persons HIV positive with less immunosuppression, as is varicella vaccine for children, but there have been no safety and efficacy data for this population. And in fact, studies of zoster vaccine safety and efficacy amongst HIV positive persons are being initiated and will guide future recommendations. Persons over 60 anticipating immunodeficiency due to initiation of treatments or progression of illness should be offered zoster vaccine. There are increasing numbers of diseases that are now being treated with various immunosuppressive medications, rheumatoid arthritis, lupus, et cetera, and patients should be screened for eligibility to get the vaccine before they become immunosuppressed. And lastly, zoster vaccine is not recommended for persons greater than 60 years of age who have received the varicella vaccine. The zoster risk in varicella vaccine recipients is still not well defined, but it appears to date to be much lower than persons who've had chickenpox instead. At this point in time, very few persons who have received the varicella vaccine are eligible for the zoster vaccine, i.e. they're not 60 years of age, and this will be true for the next decade or more. And so as data aggregate on risk and severity of zoster after varicella vaccination, we will reevaluate this guidance. And then the last thing, monitoring and reporting of adverse events following administration of zoster vaccine is emphasized. Zoster vaccine is the first live attenuated vaccine targeted to the elderly, and it presents special safety monitoring challenges in this population. There's a high level of background noise, i.e. incident medical events like heart attacks, Alzheimer's diagnoses, and falls and strokes. That occur in this population, and prevalent chronic disease. On the other hand, prevalent chronic diseases can pose unexpected risks, and multiple medications can pose unexpected risks. So the bottom line is adverse medical events may be coincident following zoster vaccine, but they may also be caused. And so significant adverse events should all be reported to VAERS. And that's the end, and this shows a particularly nasty case of shingles.